Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about Madame Bovary. Madame Bovary. Part 3, Chapter 7, the first half. Oh dear, a spot of bother for Emma. The repo men are in to repo her stuff. Emma, Charolette says, Emma has made one bad decision after another. At this point, I just can't summon the will to care how the money troubles end. Mango Mondo says, at this point, I'm just spite reading. Emma deserves her downfall. I love that, says Laura Weistich, that she threw away her last coin and now she's just hoping that Luro dies. Swims to the Mama Fishy said, well, if she was going to throw away her last coin, at least it was to the poor beggar that Hermes ridicules and also asks for the change back. I loved it as well. Carlet said, right, it seemed like a grand thing to her to throw it away like this. She's still thinking only of her appearances rather than actually trying to solve her problems. She is such an idiot. Like, just one of maybe the dumbest characters we've seen so far in all this literature. Oh, there's a mozzie circling around me. Hold on. Oh, I lost it. Had it. Lost it. Yeah, just an absolute buffoon. Buffoon. There, I said it. Shaved my head today. It just feels so nice to run my fingers along my spiky scalp. Shaved it down to like, I don't know, like stubble length. Like if you've got stubbly beard, like a 5 p.m. shadow or whatever they call it. Feels nice. That's my isolation update. I haven't given you guys an isolation update for a week or so. There it is. Today I shaved my head and ate a couple of sausages. And that's about all I've got to report. Oh, actually, another thing I've got to report. I jumped on Amazon Prime Video. Prime Video. Just the free 1 month trial. I probably won't continue it after that because I don't really want to pay for a subscription. But I watched a show called Patriot on there over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. I've been binging my way through the 2 seasons of Patriot. Very, very good show. Would very highly recommend. Terrible name. I don't know why they named it Patriot, because that makes it sound like one of those, like, I don't know, kind of political House of Cards or something like that kind of show. But it's about a folk guitar singing secret agent type guy in Europe. It's like a comedy drama. I don't know. I won't explain it, but it's really good. The one thing I will tell you that was really awesome is that when he sings his folk music, they say his songs are too personal because he gives away details of like the secret missions that he's on in his folk songs, because I don't know why, he just can't help it. He sings his personal songs and that's what's happening in his life. I don't know. It's quite amusing. Really, really good show. So there you go. If you're looking for an isolation thing to do, get yourself Patriot and watch it. Brilliant. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, I thought it would be useful and interesting to review how Emma got to this point. This is from Schmoop. Okay, here we go. This is a bit of a long comment. It's about as long as the chapter, but I'm actually pretty interested in doing this little recap, so let's do this little recap. We first see Emma at Le Berteau rather ineptly attempting to help with her father's broken leg. Charles keeps visiting Le Berteau, supposedly to check on Monsieur Rault, but really to check out Emma. After an unchaperoned visit in which Emma talks her head off and Charles sits and listens, the two get engaged. Emma wants a ridiculously romantic wedding at midnight, but her dad says no. The actual wedding is a big affair in village society, and all the guests gorge themselves. Emma returns to Tosters with Charles. We learn about Emma's past as a Catholic schoolgirl. Emma begins to feel unhappy about her marriage. She wonders if she was ever in love at all. She gets a puppy. Jali, who becomes her closest companion. Emma impresses a local aristocrat, and he invites the Bovarys to a ball. At the La Vaubyessard ball, Emma gets her first taste of the good life. She's infatuated by it. After the ball, she can't stop thinking about her contact with wealth. Emma starts to obsess over the idea of Parisian life. She creates an exotic image, an exotic imaginary world populated by rich and beautiful lords and ladies. At this stage, Emma is a good housewife. She impresses Charles with her redecoration of the house and her little touches here and there. Her habits are somewhat expensive, but he doesn't care. Emma, however, gets more and more irritated with her husband and with her life in general. She falls into a depression and suffers from uncontrollable mood swings. Charles, distraught, decides to move away from Tostes in the hopes that Emma will recover. As they leave, we discover that Emma is pregnant. The new town, Yonville-les-Abbayes, is indeed larger than Tostes, but that's not exactly saying much. It's still a smallish market town not far from Rouen. The Bovary's arrival in Yonville isn't very fortuitous. Jali, the dog, is lost. Emma meets Leon Dupuis, a young clerk, and the two quickly become friends. They are both interested in books, music, and art. Emma gives birth to a baby girl. She's disappointed she wanted a boy. She can't decide upon a name and eventually chooses Bert. Emma realizes that first that Leon is in love with her and then that she is in love with him. She builds up a new fantasy life with him at the center. At home, things get worse and worse. Emma can't stand Charles and her discontent explodes into rage. She attempts to resolve her issues by playing the role of a good wife, and even goes to talk to Father Bernicien in an attempt to slow off her spiritual angst. It doesn't work. When Leon moves away, Emma's fantasies are shattered. Once again, her emotions spiral out of control. Charles asks his mother for advice. The older woman comes to visit and antagonizes her daughter-in-law rather than helping. She thinks Emma reads too many novels, which are supposedly corrupting her. Then, just when things are at their nadir, a new man comes into Emma's life, Rudolf Belanger. Emma impresses Rudolf with her beauty and utility. She helps Charles with a bloodletting procedure and doesn't faint. Yonville throws a big agricultural fair and Rudolf escorts Emma around the exhibits. He at the top of his flirting game and Emma falls for this poor little rich man act. After the fair, Rudolf convinces Charles to let Emma go horseback riding. Emma resists for a brief while, perhaps knowing the danger of going anywhere. I just realized a button is falling off my cardigan. Got slightly distracted. Avoiding the danger of going anywhere with Rudolf, but gives in when she can order a new riding outfit. Rudolf and Emma set out for the woods, and Emma observes Yonville from a distance with disgust. In the woods, Rudolf leads Emma to a secluded glade and declares his love for her. She resists at first, but quickly surrenders herself, her body and soul, to him. Emma feels like a different woman. She's an adulteress and is proud of it. She feels as though she has attained a higher, almost mythical state of being. Emma starts to spend money recklessly, pushing extravagant gifts on Rudolf. Monsieur Leroux keeps pushing her to buy more, and she borrows money from him to pay for it. Enamored, Emma gives in totally to her passion for Rudolf, even taking rather absurd risks to visit at his chateau in the early mornings. Rudolf warns Emma that she's getting too careless. She begins to worry about being discovered. The two lovers find a new meeting place in a secluded garden behind the Bovary house. Emma and Rudolf's affairs begin to cool down. She starts to feel guilty and even attempts to love her little daughter more. She wonders why she can't love Charles. Speaking of which, Hermes tells Emma about a new treatment available for club feet. The two of them decide that Charles should undertake this operation on a local club foot, Hippolyte. Charles gives in and says he'll do it. Emma gets excited because it could bring Charles fame and renown. She begins to cautiously warm up to her husband. Unfortunately, the operation is a disaster. Hippolyte ends up with his leg amputated. Emma's disgust for Charles returns. Emma is the one who insists on paying for a peg leg. Emma runs back to Rudolph's arms, and they start up their affair with renewed vigor. Things intensify, and Emma convinces Rudolph that they should run away together. She totally believes that it's going to happen, but he has major doubts. Rudolph doubts win in the end, and he writes Emma a totally sappy breakup letter on the same day they're supposed to elope. Emma falls into the worst depression yet. It destroys her emotionally and physically. After a slow recovery, Emma suggests that Charles take Emma to Rouen to see the opera, hoping that it'll cheer her up. Unfortunately, the opera is Lucia de Lammermoor, a cheery little diversion about a heroine that goes mad when forced to marry a man she doesn't love. This hits a little too close to home. However, some good does come from this outing for Emma. She and Charles run into Leon, who's done with law school and returned to Rouen, a man of the world. They leave the theatre early to go and talk. Leon convinces Charles that Emma should stay in Rouen for an extra day to see the end of the opera. We know that he really wants to stay and hang out with him. Leon shows up at Emma's hotel, the next day to woo her. They admit their love for each other. Emma attempts to hold herself back. That evening, she decides to break things off with Leon before they even start and writes him an explanatory letter. However, she delivers said letter herself and gets entangled with Leon all over again. They meet in the cathedral at Rouen, and after a comical tour given by an overdetermined guide, the couple gets into a horse-drawn cab to work out their differences. We can only guess what happens inside the cab as it drives around all day. It's obviously by the end of it that Emma and Leon are now an item. Emma hurries back to Yonville and is told to go next door to the pharmacy. There she is met by a big to-do in the Homais household. Justin almost accidentally used a jar of contaminated with arsenic for jam, and Monsieur Homais is totally enraged. Emma discovers the whole family panicking in the closet where the poisons are kept. In the hustle and bustle, Monsieur Homais bluntly tells her that her father-in-law is dead. Emma returns home to find Charles distraught. Instead of being sympathetic, she is impatient with him. She wants to be alone so she can think about her new affair. Monsieur Leroux arrives to discuss the many loans that the Bovarys have taken out. He ends up selling some more items to Emma, thus increasing the loans rather than decreasing them. Leroux convinces Emma to talk to Charles about gaining power of attorney, which would give her the right to control the couple's financial matters. Emma brings the power of attorney up with Charles, who agrees, and then goes to Rouen, supposedly to talk to Leon about the contract. Emma remains in Rouen for 3 days, enjoying her time with her new lover. To enable her visits to Rouen, Emma becomes a master liar. She tells Charles she goes into town every Thursday for piano lessons. Her time with Leon is the highlight of each week. Emma's lies grow more and more convoluted, and she has to explain why she doesn't come home on one Thursday. Finances continue to get worse. Leroux convinces Emma to let him handle the sale of a small property that Charles's father left in his will. Despite the money from the sale, Emma is up to her ears in debt, but she continues to spend glibly. She doesn't have the patience to figure out exactly how much she owes. Things with Leon start to cool off, especially after one Thursday in which he fails to meet her at the hotel room. Monsieur Homais is in town to visit for the day and won't let Leon get away. One day, all of Emma's chickens come home to roost. Monsieur Leroux decides that it's time to cash in on all her debts. She manages to put him off for a while and does everything she can to earn some money. She attempts to sell all her beautiful things, but it's no use. She even forces Leon to pawn some spoons her father gave her for her wedding. After a long debauched night of partying in Rouen with Leon and her friends, Emma realizes just how low she has sunk. The other women present are prostitutes. Horrified, Emma rushes home. Her repentance is too late, though Leroux has had her property seized. She owes 8,000 francs to be delivered in the next 24 hours. Oh dear. Emma. You are a silly, silly girl. Okay, let's read on, shall we? Here we go. At 9 o'clock in the morning, she was awakened by the sound of voices in the place. There was a crowd round the market reading a large bill fixed to one of the posts. She saw Justin, who was climbing onto a stone and tearing down the bill. But at this moment, the rural guard seized him by the collar. Monsieur Homais came out of his shop, and Mia Lafrandois, in the midst of the crowd, seemed to be perorating. "Madame, madame," cried Felicity, running in, "it's abominable." And the poor girl, deeply moved, handed her a yellow paper that she had just torn off the door. Emma read with a glance that all her furniture was for sale. Then they looked at one another silently. The servant and mistress had no secret from one another. At last, Felicity sighed, "If I were you, madam, I should go to Monsieur Guillaumin. Do you think," and this question was meant to say, "you who know the house through the servant, has the master spoken sometimes of me? Yes, you'd do well to go there." She dressed, put on her black gown and her hood with jet beads, and that she might not be seen, there was still a crowd in the place. She took the path by the river outside the village. She reached the notary's gate quite breathless. The sky was sombre, and a little snow was falling. At the sound of the bell, Theodore in a red waistcoat appeared on the steps. He came to the open the door almost familiarly, as to an acquaintance, and showed her into the dining room. A large porcelain stove crackled beneath a cactus that filled up the niche in the wall, and in the black wood frames, against the oak-stained paper, hung Steuben's Esmeralda and Chopin's Potiphar. The ready-laid table, the two silver chafing dishes, the crystal doorknobs, the parquet and the furniture all shone with a scrupulous English cleanliness. The windows were ornamented at each corner with stained glass. "Now this," thought Emma, "is the dining room I ought to have." The notary came in pressing his palm leaf dressing gown to his breast with his left arm, while with the other hand he raised and quickly put on again his brown velvet cap, pretentiously cocked on the right side, whence looked out the end of three fair curls drawn from the back of the head, following the line of his bald skull. After he had offered her a seat, he sat down to breakfast, apologizing profusely for his rudeness. "I have come," she said, "to beg you, sir." "What, madam? I am listening." And she began explaining her position to him. Monsieur Guillaumin knew it, being secretly associated with the line draper, from whom he always got capital for the loans on mortgages that he was asked to make. So he knew, and better than herself, the long story of the bills, small at first, bearing different names as endorsers, made out at long dates and constantly renewed, up to the day when, gathering together all the protested bills, the shopkeeper had bidden his friend Vincart take in his own name all the necessary proceedings, not wishing to pass for a tiger with his fellow citizens. She mingled her story with recriminations against Leroux, to which the notary replied from time to time with some significant word. Eating his cutlet and drinking his tea, he buried his chin in his sky-blue cravat, into which were thrust two diamond pins, held together by a small gold chain, and he smiled, a singular smile, in a sugary, ambiguous fashion. But noticing that her feet were damp, he said, "Do get closer to the stove. Put your feet up against the porcelain." She was afraid of dirtying it. The notary replied in a gallant tone, "Beautiful things spoil nothing." Then she tried to move him, and growing moved herself, she began telling him about the poorness of her home, her worries, her wants. He could understand that, an elegant woman, and without leaving off eating, he had turned completely round towards her so that his knee brushed against her boot, whose sole curled round as it smoked against the stove. But when she asked for 1,000 sous, he closed his lips and declared that he was very sorry he had not had the management of her fortune before, for there were hundreds of ways very convenient even for a lady of turning her money to account. They might either in the turf pits of Grumesnil or building ground of Havre, almost without risk, have ventured on some excellent speculations. And he let her consume herself with rage at the thought of the fabulous sums that she would certainly have made. "How was it," he went on, "that you didn't come to me?" "I hardly know," she said. "Why, hey, did I frighten you so much? It is I, on the contrary, who ought to complain. We hardly know one another, yet I am very devoted to you. You do not doubt that, I hope. He held out his hand, took hers, covered it with greedy kisses, then held it to his knee, and he played delicately with her fingers while he murmured a thousand blandishments. His insipid voice murmured like a running brook. A light shone in his eyes through the glimmering of his spectacles, and his hand was advancing up Emma's sleeve to press her arm. She felt against her cheek his panting breath. This man oppressed her horribly. She sprang up and said to him, "Sir, I am waiting." "For what?" said the notary, who suddenly became very pale. "This money." "But..." Then, yielding to the outburst of too powerful a desire, "Well, yes." He dragged himself towards her on his knees, regardless of his dressing gown. "For pity's sake, stay, I love you." He seized her by the waist. Madame Bovary's face flushed purple. She recoiled with a terrible look, crying, "You are taking a shameless advantage of my distress, sir. I am to be pitied, not to be sold." And she went out. The notary remained quite stupefied, his eyes fixed on his fine embroidered slippers. They were a love gift, and the sight of them at last consoled him. Besides, he reflected that such an adventure might have carried him too far. "What a wretch, what a scoundrel, what an infamy," she said to herself as she fled with nervous steps beneath the aspens of the path. The disappointment of her failure increased the indignation of her outraged modesty. It seemed to her that Providence pursued her implacably, and strengthening herself in her pride, she had never felt so much esteem for herself nor so much contempt for others. A spirit of warfare transformed her. She would have liked to strike all men, to spit in their faces, to crush them, and she walked rapidly, straight on, pale, quivering, maddened, searching the empty horizon with tear-dimmed eyes, and as it were rejoicing in the hate that was choking her. When she saw her house, a numbness came over her. She could not go on, and yet she must. Besides, whither could she flee? Felicity was waiting for her at the door. "Well?" "No," said Emma. And for a quarter of an hour the two of them went over the various persons in Yonville who might perhaps be inclined to help her, but each time that Felicity named someone, Emma replied, "Impossible, they will not." "And the master will soon be in. I know that well enough, leave me alone." She had tried everything. There was nothing more to be done now, and when Charles came in she would have to say to him, "Go away. This carpet on which you are walking is no longer ours. In your own house you do not possess a chair, a pin, a straw, and it is I, poor man, who have ruined you." Then there would be a great sob. Next he would weep abundantly, and at last, just the surprise past, he would forgive her. "Yes," she murmured, grinding her teeth, "he will forgive me, who would have given a million if I would forgive him for having known me. Never, never." This thought of Bovary's superiority to her exasperated her. Then, whether she confessed or did not confess, presently, immediately, tomorrow, he would know the catastrophe all the same. So she must wait for this horrible scene and bear the weight of his magnanimity. The desire to return to La Rose seized her. What would be the use to write to her father? It was too late, and perhaps she began to repent now that she had not yielded to that other. When she heard the trot of a horse in the alley, it was he. He was opening the gate. He was whiter than the plaster wall. Rushing to the stairs, she ran out quickly to the square, and the wife of the mayor, who was talking to Lester Boudoir in front of the church, saw her go into the tax collectors. She hurried off to tell Madame Caron, and the two ladies went up to the attic and, hidden by some linen spread across props, stationed themselves comfortably for overlooking the whole of Bennett's room. He was alone in his garret, busy imitating in wood one of those indescribable bits of ivory composed of crescents and spheres hollowed out one within the other, the whole as straight as an obelisk, and of no use whatever. And he was beginning on the last piece. He was nearing his goal. In the twilight of the wood shop, the white dust was flying from his tools like a shower of sparks under the hoofs of a galloping horse. The two wheels were turning, droning. Bennett smiled, his chin lowered, his nostrils distended, and, in a word, seemed lost in one of those complete happinesses that no doubt belong only to commonplace occupations, which amuse the mind with facile difficulties and satisfy by a realization of that beyond which such minds have not a dream. Ah, there she is, exclaimed Madame Tuvache. But it was impossible because of the lay to hear what she was saying. At last, these ladies thought they made out the word francs, and Madame Tuvache whispered in a low voice, she's begging him to give her time for paying her taxes. Apparently, replied the other. They saw her walking up and down, examining the napkin rings, the candlesticks, the banister rails against the walls, while Binet stroked his beard with satisfaction. Do you think she wants to order something of him? Said Madame Tuvache. Why, he doesn't sell anything, objected her neighbour. The tax collector seemed to be listening with wide-open eyes, as if he did not understand. She went on in a tender, suppliant manner. She came nearer to him, her breast heaving. They no longer spoke. Is she making him advances? Said Madame Tuvache. Binet was scarlet to his very ears. She took hold of his hands. Oh, it's too much. And no doubt she was suggesting something abominable to him, for the tax collector, yet he was brave and had fought at Borzen and at Lutzen, had been through the French campaign and had even been recommended for the cross, suddenly, as at the sight of a serpent, recoiled as far as he could from her, crying, Madam, what do you mean? Women like that ought to be whipped, said Madame Tuvache. But where is she? Continued Madame Caron, for she had disappeared whilst they spoke, and then, catching sight of her going up the Grand Rue, and turning to the right as if making for the cemetery, they were lost in conjectures. Nurse Rollet, she said on reaching the nurses, I am choking, unlace me. She fell on the bed sobbing. Nurse Rollet covered her with a petticoat and remained standing by her side. Then, as she did not answer, the good woman withdrew, took her wheel and began spinning flax. Oh, leave off, she murmured, fancying she heard Binet's lathe. What's bothering her, said the nurse to herself. Why has she come here? She had rushed thither, impelled by a kind of horror that drove her from home. Lying on her back motionless and with staring eyes, she saw things, but vaguely, although she tried to, with idiotic persistence. She looked at the scales on the walls, two brands smoking end to end, and on a long spider crawling over her head in a rent in the beam. At last she began to collect her thoughts. She remembered one day, Leon, oh, how long ago that was, the sun was shining on the river, and the clematis were perfuming the air. Then, carried away as by a rushing torrent, she soon began to recall the day before. What time is it? She asked. Mia Rollet went out, raised the fingers of her right hand to that side of the sky that was brightest, and came back slowly, saying, nearly three. Ah, thanks, thanks. For he would come, he would have found some money. But he would perhaps go down yonder, not guessing she was here, and she told the nurse to run to her house to fetch him. Be quick. But, my dear lady, I'm going, I'm going. She wondered now that she had not thought of him from the first. Yesterday he had given his word. He would not break it, and she already saw herself at Leroux's spreading out her three bank notes on his bureau. Then she would have to invent some story to explain matters to Bovary. What should it be? The nurse, however, was a long while gone, but as there was no clock in the cot, Emma feared she was perhaps exaggerating the length of time. She began walking round the garden step by step. She went into the path by the hedge and returned quickly, hoping that the woman would have come back by another road. At last, weary of waiting, assailed by fears that she thrust from her, no longer conscious whether she had been here a century or a moment, she sat down in a corner, closed her eyes, and stopped her ears. The gate grated, she sprang up. Before she had spoken, Mia Rollet said to her, There is no one at your house. What? Oh, no, no one. And the doctor is crying. He is calling for you. They're looking for you. Emma answered nothing. She gasped as she turned her eyes about, while the peasant woman, frightened at her face, drew back instinctively, thinking her mad. Suddenly she struck her brow and uttered a cry, for the thought of Rudolph, like a flash of lightning in a dark night, had passed into her soul. He was so good, so delicate, so generous, and besides, should he hesitate to do her this service, she would know well enough how to constrain him to it by reawaking, in a single moment, their lost love. So she set out towards La Huchette, not seeing that she was hastening to offer herself to that which but a while ago had so angered her, not in the least conscious of her prostitution. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Emma Bovary. You've really lost the bloody plot. Love, you've gone down the bloody gurgler. Have your say about this chapter over at the subreddit, and I will see you tomorrow.